Now it's almost 70 years since what I consider, and many others consider, the assassination of the greatest living revolutionary at that time, Leon Trotsky. He was assassinated, as is well known, by an agent of Stalin and the Stalinist apparatus in Russia, Ramon Mercader, who, by the way, when he was released after a long prison cell, was spirited back behind the so-called Iron Curtain and was welcomed in the Stalinist state, given the order of Lenin, a horrible perversion, actually, of the idea of Lenin itself. These facts are very well known, particularly to the comrades who are in this meeting here today. But we have a second assassination that is taking place in Trotsky. It's less bloody, but it's more pernicious in a way, because this is a literary assassination of Trotsky. You know, after the end of the English Civil War and the replacement of the regime of Oliver Cromwell, the dictatorship of Oliver Cromwell, but nevertheless, from the point of view of the bourgeois, a very progressive figure, the royalist counter-revolution dug up his body, hung it on a gibbet outside the parliament and allowed it to rot. There it was there for the carrion, for the rats and so on and so forth. Well, they've not done the same, or at least bourgeois public opinion has not done the same. But this book by Robert Service, I make the point in the review, it's a very heavy book. It was quite a sickening situation, by the way, to have to read the book. We got the book well in advance because we estimated that something like Service's approach in this book was going to be necessary for the ruling class, for a very simple reason, by the way, that given the growth of the social crisis in Britain on the backs of the economic crisis and internationally, it would be necessary for the ideologues of the bourgeois to actually rubbish Trotsky's account of his own life in particular, but in particular the record of Trotsky in the workers' movement over decades. By the way, when Trotsky's My Life was first produced in the 1930s, and he did it reluctantly, partly because the movement needed money at that stage, there was not one literary review, not one critical review that disputed any of the facts in Trotsky's My Life. Not one single article was produced to challenge the role of Trotsky historically, his ideas, and so on, and particularly the account that he gives in My Life. We have to wait for 70 years after his death to see now not the Stalinist school of falsification, but the bourgeois school of falsification. Let's go further, the Service school of falsification. Try as I might to find something positive to say in this about this book, it was very difficult, because every word was a mistake, and some were two mistakes, by the way. So bad was this particular book. We challenged him to a debate. We even considered putting a cardboard cutout of Robert Service up here today, so he'd be with us in spirit. But that doesn't mean to say that because he's not here, we shouldn't, in this discussion, go over Trotsky's ideas, and in particular, it's not a question of living in the past, but learning from the past. How do those ideas, how relevant are they to the modern era, and particularly to the role of Marxists and the followers of Trotsky, the Trotskyists today? The attack on the Trotskyists by Robert Service, and the main challenge, by the way, is apart from the fact that he was a terrorist, no discrimination about the kind of terror that was used in the Civil War. I'll comment on that in a moment. But also that he was undemocratic. And yet, as I said at the rally last night, not only has Service refused to debate today, he accepted an invitation by a person in Russia, I won't say much more than that, for a debate a week on Thursday, which, by the way, will be televised as well. He gave an oral consent to that. And then he said, well, it was difficult, because he was smelling a rat from his point of view. He said, well, it was difficult to speak on that occasion, but maybe he could do a television link-up, a video link-up from London. And only after he discovered that I was one of the people on the panel did he withdraw his position. I mentioned that at the rally last night. What is that but a reflection of fear, after writing this book, of discussing with one individual, it doesn't have to be me, It could be any member of the Socialist Party, frankly, who could discuss the ideas that Service has put forward. What happened 70 years ago, almost 70 years ago, was the death of the greatest living revolutionary at the time. He was great like Marx. He had a tremendous intellect, of that there is no dispute. But Trotsky is famous, not because of his intellect, like with Marx, but because of his method. That's why we defend the heritage of Trotsky in applying that method to the modern era today. You will find some mistakes in what Trotsky wrote, especially of timing, as you will find, for instance, in the works of ourselves in relation to great events. That is indisputable. Occasionally got it wrong. I can only, by studying Trotsky, all the works of Trotsky, most of them, I believe, in English, I can only question Trotsky on two issues. One was in relation to South Africa, another was on a secondary question. But on most issues, he was amazingly right, including, by the way, the analysis of the situation up to the Second World War itself. Now, his record alone in the revolutionary movement would mean that this man would be one of the pantheon of the greats of socialism and Marxism. He was the organizer of the Red Army. He was decisive in the Russian Civil War, which, remember, defeated not only internal reaction, but the 21 armies of imperialism itself, which defeated the counter-revolution. He played a crucial role in the Comintern. But as a matter of fact, Trotsky himself said his most decisive contribution was not in the Russian Revolution. It wasn't in the Civil War. It wasn't the construction of the Red Army, brick by brick, out of very limited material, which became a marvelous force that defeated the bourgeois internally and externally. But it was because of his analysis of the degeneration of the Russian Revolution, of Stalinism, which is very crucial. I touched on it yesterday, I'll go over some of the points in these opening remarks, in actually shaping the world today. You only have to pose the question, where would we be, where would Marxism have been, without the analysis of Trotsky of Stalinism, and the ramifications and the implications of that? It was a tremendous example of a dialectical, which means an all-sided analysis of the phenomena of the growth of bureaucratism in the isolation of the revolution in Russia itself. Now, Service is full of gross errors. He suggests in this book, as I mentioned in my review, well, Trotsky really didn't develop the theory of the permanent revolution. That was the property of Alexander Helfand, known as Paris. Now, if you read Trotsky's My Life, or any comment he makes on the theory of the permanent revolution, he says, well, of course, Helfand contributed the lion's share of the theory of the permanent revolution, in the sense that he agreed with Trotsky that in Russia, the capitalist democratic revolution, that is land reform, unification of the country, the overthrow of the thousand-year Tsarist regime, that capitalist democratic revolution could not be carried through by the so-called liberal capitalists. Because the industrial capitalists were tied to the land in the modern era, the land is tied to industry, and for instance, if you take a country like India, the completion of the capitalist democratic revolution, of a thorough land reform, is not complete in India at the present time. But to carry through a massive agrarian revolution comes up against the opposition, not just of the landlords, but of the capitalists. And therefore, Trotsky said, they would not complete this revolution. Who could carry it through then? That would have to be carried through by the working class, and Helfand agreed with this, but then Helfand stopped short and said, well, the kind of regime in an alliance with the peasantry that would come out of this would be something like the Labour governments in Australia, where the first Labour government in history came to power at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century. But these governments were within the framework of capitalism. They didn't challenge capitalism. And Trotsky went further than Helfand and said, no, if the working class comes to power, it will complete the capitalist democratic revolution. But having come to power, it couldn't stop there. It would then go over to the socialist task. Not only in Russia, because in isolation, Russia wasn't ready for socialism. All trends of opinion in Russia at that stage agreed. But from a world point of view, capitalism was rotten ripe for overthrow. And therefore, the Russian Revolution would be the spark that would ignite the world revolution itself. And how marvellously that was actually confirmed by the march of events itself. Lenin was indisputable as the leader with Trotsky of the Russian Revolution. Lenin came to the position of Trotsky. It wasn't the other way around. On the test of the revolution, Trotsky was more correct than Lenin, by the way. But Lenin, with that genius for improvising in the situation and seeing how the process developed, in effect, Lenin and Trotsky came to the same position in the run-up and in the course of the Russian Revolution. And in a private conversation with one of Trotsky's friends, Yoff, he admitted that Trotsky was right on the permanent revolution. Lenin was never a kind of vain individual who, when a mistake was made, either by himself, by the young workers' state, or by anybody else, or when they were correct, he was very generous in admitting that a mistake had been made by him, that the other person was right, because truth, telling the truth in the workers' movement, is not an option. You have to tell the truth, both about victories and defeats. If you have a defeat, if you have a setback, and you don't openly correct that setback, then you prepare for bigger mistakes and bigger faults in the future. That's why the socialist and the militant before was ruthless when we made a mistake. Like in Liverpool, didn't come up, I believe, in the session of Liverpool yesterday, on the redundancy notices, we told the truth. Not after the fact, but at the time. This was a mistake. And we, in the course of that, we tried to prepare our comrades for the situation of a similar position in the future, which would in effect be repeated if it wasn't corrected in that way. Now, as is known, the isolation of the Russian Revolution led to the rise of the bureaucracy. But let us not forget, in stating that fact, that before then, there was numerous opportunities for the working class to take power. In Hungary in 1919, buffered the mistake that was made by Belokon. The German workers battered at the foundations of capitalism in 1918 to 1923. And by the way, Servus, in his material on Germany, says, well, Trotsky took no interest in 1923. If you read the analysis of Trotsky, and we're going to write material, by the way, on 1923, because the German Revolution, in some ways, is more important for us, because it was in a highly industrialized country, than even the Russian Revolution. As marvelous as it was in a backward country. Germany approximates more, and the process of revolution and counter-revolution approximates more to the task that we face now in the advanced industrial countries itself. But Germany was on the verge of revolution in 1923. They could have taken power, the German workers, in a period of 3 months. As a matter of fact, the leader of the German Communist Party, Brandler, went to Moscow and had discussions about taking the power. And in one discussion, he said to Trotsky, I've got no doubt we could take the power. And we could establish a Soviet Germany. The problem is what happens afterwards. And Trotsky said to Brandler, you don't know what's going to happen afterwards. It could be civil war. The ruling class may not be able to resist, but you've got to take the power now. And Brandler felt his own inadequacies to such an extent that he actually suggested that Trotsky be sent secretly to Germany to organize the insurrection. That was vetoed by Stalin and by Zinoviev for personal ambition, for their own personal position. But this man is a professor. He's a learned professor in history. How can he make a mistake like that in examining the archives? But that's the kind of thing that they'd be able to get away with. No more. We're going to refute these gross distortions of the position of Trotsky in order to prepare the situation in the future. Now, another point that he makes, that Servus makes, is that Trotsky was no different to Stalin. And this is a vital point for us to understand. In other words, both of them presided over a bureaucratic regime. Now, let us concede, by the way. Lenin described the state of Russia, the workers' state of Russia, from 1917 to 1923, which in my opinion was the most democratic state, especially in the early stages. The Soviets were somewhat emasculated during the Civil War and the isolation of the revolution. But with the revolution, the most revolutionary party in history, you have to say, in our opinion, this is the most democratic state in history. But Lenin and Trotsky didn't pull the wool over the workers' eyes. They said this was a workers' state, but with bureaucratic problems, let's put it like that. Bureaucratic features. And what he meant by that is because of the isolation of the revolution, the destruction of the working class, you've had even bureaucratic features under their regime. But it was nothing compared to the Stalinist state. It's like a pimple on a body compared to an ulcer, a cancerous ulcer that eats away with the body and eventually results in, of course, the restoration of capitalism as we've seen it. His arguments in relation to Lenin and Trotsky was absolutely false, by the way. I haven't got time to deal with the application of the permanent revolution. Others will come in. But in the neo-colonial world, Trotsky was more correct on the question of Germany, for instance, not just in 23, but in the run-up to the triumph of Stalin of Hitler in 1933. The fact is that Trotsky was very careful in his analysis of Stalinism. When an old Trotskyist, as he was at that stage, C.L.R. James, wrote a book called The World Revolution in the late 1930s. He was a cricketing expert as well, by the way, C.L.R. James. Very English in that sense, combining revolution with cricket, not with golf, as is the case today. But in the course of this book, he makes the point, C.L.R. James makes the point, that Stalin wanted the defeat of the Chinese Revolution of 25-27. And he wanted the defeat of the Communist Party in Germany between 1930 and 1933. Now that is wrong. Trotsky corrected him on that. He didn't argue that Stalin or Radek or Zinoviev or Kamenev rather, that they wanted the conscious defeat of the revolution at that stage. The mistakes that arose, the loss of the opportunities that were presented, was because of the rise of a conservative stratum, which replaced the idea of the world revolution with the creature comforts of the bureaucracy at home, and replaced relying on the workers' struggle internationally with collaboration with the tops of the workers' organisations. That's what happened in Britain in the 1926 general strike, when the Communist Party tail-ended the general council of the TUC. So it was bureaucratic mistakes that were made at this stage, carefully analysed by Trotsky. But once the defeat of Hitler took place, and especially followed by the upheavals in Spain, the whole situation absolutely changed by this stage. Because the bureaucracy, particularly under the impression of the Spanish Revolution and the internal convulsions that were developing in Russia itself, the bureaucracy had gone from a factor in a situation where mistakes led to defeats, which in turn promoted in Russia a more conservative attitude, which in turn led to further defeats, and so on. In other words, it was a dialectical interreaction between what happened in Russia and what happened internationally as well. But by the time of the Purge trials of 1936, 1937, particularly 1937, 1938, the whole situation had begun to change. In Spain, we have to remember this, by the way, against the background of this world crisis. At the rally last night, we touched on the question of this crisis. But there's a difference between what happened in the 1930s and what is taking place, at least at this stage. Because in the 1930s, we had the devastating crisis. We had a kind of paralysis on an industrial level of the working class, for instance, in America. But politically, because of the existence of powerful socialist and communist parties, the masses were radicalized. Even in America, the Communist Party grew quite dramatically. Now, one of the big differences today with the situation in the 1930s is that doesn't exist at this moment in time. And why? Because there's no mass pole of attraction which can assist the working class, as yet anyway, to draw the necessary conclusions. That's why we argue for a new mass party of the working class. Who's arguing for socialism, by the way, outside the ranks of the Socialist Party and the CWI? Well, Bob Crow mentioned it last night, the first time, by the way, that he's mentioned socialism in relation to the question of a new party in Britain. That's the impact that we've managed to make on some of the leading figures in the movement. But there were mass socialist and communist parties. There was a kind of level of understanding amongst broad masses. The choice was between different schools of socialism at that stage. In that, at the present time, consciousness is being thrown back, has not yet been caught up yet with the objective development of events, and that's why we put forward this idea of a new mass party of the working class. In Spain, between 1931 and 1937, the Spanish workers had not one opportunity. They had 10 opportunities to take power. For those communities who haven't studied the Spanish Revolution, imagine a working class that has four-fifths of the power in its hands. That when Franco took power on July 17th, 1936, the socialist leaders, like today, like the TUC, merely protested against Franco, and the socialist workers were knocking on the door for arms. It was the heroic Barcelona proletariat who rose with chair legs, with the ends of tables, with primitive instruments, and marched against the barracks, smashed the fascists in Barcelona. Then with Durruti improvising, 10,000 Army of Liberation that marched through Catalonia, marched through Aragon into the gates of Madrid, and stopped Franco in his tracks. Four-fifths of Spain was in the hands of the working class. But because of the policies of Popular Frontism, which is entirely opposed to everything that the Bolsheviks did, they handed the power back to the bourgeois. The bourgeois didn't even have its own state, by the way. The police and the army had fled to the side of Franco, and all that was left was the shadow of the capitalists at that stage. And as a result of the role of the Stalinists, they restored the shadow. They gave the shadow substance, and a bourgeois state was recreated, and we know Franco triumphed in all the horrors that then were inflicted on the working class of Spain. But Spain had a dramatic effect in the Soviet Union itself. Even on members of the bureaucracy, the memory was stirred about the Russian Revolution. What was the reaction of Stalin? I think even we have underestimated the effects of the Moscow trials of 37 and 38. It's particularly brought out in this marvellous book by Vadim Rogivin. I'm doing a review for the Socialism Today in the next period. And what was brought home in this book is the crucial role in the triumph of the market, by the way, in Russia, 50, 60 years later, in 1990, because of what was done in Russia in 1936, 1937, 1938. When Servius says, well, Stalin was just an outgrowth of Bolshevism, he couldn't have been more wrong. That's the most serious mistake that's made in this book. Stalinism was not, as these professors say, an outgrowth of Bolshevism. It was the complete negation of Bolshevism. A river of blood was created, deliberately, by the way, by Stalin and the bureaucracy to break the umbilical cord, even linking the bureaucracy, by the way, to the Russian Revolution itself. Why was people like Zinoviev, Kamenev, who capitulated to Stalin, why were they put on trial and accused of being at one and the same time agents of British imperialism on one stage, and then suddenly agents of Hitler, or agents of the Mikado? Why did this grotesque trial take place in this way? This was a one-sided civil war by Stalinism against the memory of the Russian Revolution. Even sections of the bureaucracy who were connected to the Russian Revolution had to be slaughtered, had to be annihilated. All the foreign communist parties whose leaders were in Moscow were shot out of hand. The leaders of the Schutzbund, who rose against the fascists in Austria in 1934, decamped Egbert in exile in Russia, and was shot out of hand. I gave the example to Tony Mulhern coming here, where the Yugoslav Communist Party were massacred, by the way. They were all massacred, every one of them apart from Tito. And he went to Dimitrov, who was a Bulgarian, and said, well, who's the leadership of the Yugoslav Communist Party today? He said, well, you're the only one left. You're the leader of this party, which then, by the way, took power in the aftermath of 1945. What Stalin was attempting to do was to blot out the memory of the working class. People like Khrushchev, it's amazing when you study the situation in the speech of Khrushchev in 1953. When Khrushchev, in his famous speech which led to the thaw, which led to the position where there was an opening up, where Khrushchev, in order to defeat the more Stalinist wing of the bureaucracy, we could put it like that, was forced to go into the record of Stalin and the Stalinism. So he lifted the curtain a little bit and began to re-examine. But Khrushchev himself admitted that he knew nothing about history. He didn't participate in the Civil War. He didn't participate in the Bolshevik Party. He didn't participate in the rich history of Russia. He was plucked from obscurity, like Gorbachev himself, by the way, like Andropov, like Brezhnev. All of them had no connection with the rich revolutionary history of Russia itself. So therefore, where is the thread? We are the thread in Britain with the history of the working class. It's in the Socialist Party. It's in the old wise heads of Alec Thraves and Tony Mulhern and of Robin and others who are leaning in that direction at the present time. We have a connection through the cadres of the Socialist Party. You have it, of course, through the democratic discussion and so on. But where was the connection between what happened in 37, 38, for the modern working class in Russia who were beginning to move against the bureaucracy? There was no accountability. If in the 1980s we would have had an accountability in Russia of Stalinism in an honest fashion, a balance sheet of what took place, then undoubtedly the best elements of the working class would have moved to examine Trotsky, the left opposition. The best of them did, by the way. They went into the secret libraries in Moscow and St. Petersburg. We got that through the contacts that we had to study history. The big files that were taken out were the speeches of the left opposition. We have to remember, when this man says, well, the Trotskyists were nothing in Russia, there were 10,000 Trotskyists in the camps in 1936, 1937. Young boys of 14 and 15, Stalin introduced a law that any child over the age of 12 who was in the family of a left oppositionist was liable to execution, to be put on trial and to be executed. And they were executed with their families as well. Every single relative of Trotsky was killed. The same with Bukharin, who capitulated, the same with Zinoviev and so on. Why? To break the historical memory of the working class, to break the traditions of workers' democracy, of the ideas of Lenin, never mind of Trotsky, the heroic ideas of the revolution itself. And therefore, these marvellous men and women, I'll mention this in conclusion by the way, were shot out of hand like dogs in the tundra, were shouting their resistance to Stalinism in the frozen tundra. Real heroes and heroines. Films will be made of them, by the way. Books will be written about them, these nameless heroes who went to their deaths shouting, long live the Russian Revolution, long live Lenin, long live Trotsky, and long live the Fourth International. And this man says, well, Trotskyism was nothing. It was wiped out, unfortunately, because of through the crimes of Stalin, but nevertheless, their memory has not been erased because it's restored by books like this by Rogovin and, of course, by ourselves in the material that we produce. By the way, before I just pass on, one of the major charges that Servius makes in this book is, well, Trotsky was in favour of terror. Trotsky never in any way apologised for the role that was played by the young workers' state. Well, who started the terror, by the way? It wasn't the working class. The working class in Russia took power relatively peacefully. Very few people were killed in the Winter Palace. They were enormously generous. Trotsky himself admitted in that film, he was talking about the Dewey Commission that was set up to examine the Moscow trial. It came out and found Trotsky and his son Leon Sedov not guilty in the Moscow trials. By the way, Solzhenitsyn also wrote a big book, The Gulag Archipelago. He doesn't mention Trotsky and Lenin were the major defendants in their absence in the Moscow trials. How can you write 1,000 pages about the Gulag, have a subhead or a little note on the Trotskyists, who were the most heroic in the camp, who went on hunger strikes and won a victory to be treated as political prisoners, and then because of that, Stalin personally gave the order that every one of them should be shot in the camps. How can you argue in this particular way that Servius does? It can only be interpreted as a monstrous new falsification of history. But one of the arguments is, when Trotsky was in favour of terrorism, the workers in Russia, as Trotsky himself said in that Dewey Commission, he said we were incredibly generous. We released General Krasnov on his say-so that he wouldn't engage in civil war. He went away and immediately organized an army of counter-revolution, and thousands of workers were slaughtered as a result of that mistake, by the way, that was made by the Bolsheviks. And I posed the question in my material, in my short review, and we go into it in any greater detail. He accuses Lenin and Trotsky of not wanting to have other parties existing in Russia between 1917 and 1922-23. On the contrary, the Mensheviks were allowed to operate, the social revolutionaries were allowed to operate, all those parties that accepted the idea of working within the framework of the system accepted. And even the Mensheviks who didn't accept the Russian Revolution were actually accepted as legal parties. They were only illegalized when they supported the whites, when they went over to the counter-revolution. The only party that was illegalized in Russia after the revolution was the Black Hundreds, the equivalent of the BNP in Britain, only much bigger than the BNP in Russia. In other words, a right-wing, semi-fascistic organization was outlawed at that stage. And I posed the question, and we get no reply to this. Did Abraham Lincoln, who was a great Democrat, who was presiding over the American Civil War, did he allow the South to operate openly in the North during the Civil War, produce newspapers, argue and mobilize a force to overthrow the government? Not at all. It was partly ruled by the sword. The Lord Oliver Cromwell, when he took power in Britain, did he allow the king and the forces in Oxford to operate freely within the territory of the parliamentarians? Not at all. And therefore, this argument of terrorism is entirely false. And we would say, by the way, this is an attempt to try and picture the Trotskyists today as favouring the methods of the Bolsheviks in the 1917 revolution and its aftermath. History's moved on. The greatest task for Marxists and Trotskyists today is to conquer the political support of the working class. So dominant are the working class in the modern era, it will not be a repeat of the Russian Revolution. This was in a backward country. That's why I mentioned Germany. When Lenin and Trotsky said it was easier to take power, wasn't easy, but it was easier to take power in Russia than it would be in an advanced industrial country. But it was more difficult to hold the power in Russia, he said, unless the revolution spread internationally because of the objective situation, the cultural backwardness, paucity of resources, and so on. That's why the main task for Marxism is today is to conquer the working class, not by force of arms, of course, but by ideas, to win over the majority of the working class. You win the majority of the working class, as was the case in Germany in 1923, the question of the socialist revolution would be much easier. Would we illegalize other parties? We say openly, no, the Tories will have every right to exist. The only difference will be that the militant, as it was, the socialist today, will be the same size and the same circulation as the Daily Express. And the Daily Express will be the size of the socialist today, probably with less actual effect on the population. We wouldn't mind Rupert Murdoch going on the street corners around here or central London and say, go back to capitalism, mass unemployment, poverty, and the rest that goes with it. It would have the same effect, by the way, today, that if somebody was arguing, let's go back to Merry England, let's go back to feudalism. But Oliver Cromwell had to take the sword to suppress feudalism and cleared the way for the development of capitalism. We wouldn't do that today because they just looked as an oddity. Anybody going, I mean, we all enjoy Morris dancing and the bells and what have you. But nevertheless, it would be looked as rather quaint. Somebody wanting to go back to that kind of society. In other words, if a workers' state was established, a democratic workers' state was established, the action would have such little basis. Of course, they would have the right to put forward their ideas, and we would defeat them in argument, in the same way as we would defeat Service, who's not confident of his position and is not prepared to argue for his situation itself. Comrades, I think that if you look at the whole arguments of Lenin and Trotsky, and particularly Trotsky's role, I've only touched on a few of the points to open up the discussion here today, you'll see it's a marvellous treasure trove. I repeat, it's not a question of Trotsky being a hero, although I say, quite frankly and openly, he's more of a hero to me than any premiership star or football club, and I'm very interested in football, as comrades might know, or any pop group and so on. This is a real hero who achieved things as far as the working class is concerned. But it's not a question of hero worship here. It's a question of method. It's a question of understanding his method of analysis, trying to learn from that, not living in the past, but applying that analysis. It seems when I lean this way, there's a difference. So I've got to lean towards the right in the next five minutes. But it's not a question of Trotsky's personality alone, or what he did. It's a question of what he represented, his ideas. And I would say to you, without understanding Stalinism, the phenomenon of Stalinism, there's an attitude in the press, maybe amongst the new generation as well. Well, the overthrow of the Berlin Wall was 20 years ago. I understand that. And Stalinism was 70 years ago. And the Russian Revolution took place almost 100 years ago, 90 years ago. Why should we study these events? Well, we're involved in a war. It's not a military war as yet. It's a class war. And if you take the bourgeois experts in war, they have their own military academies. They don't study just the Second World War or the First World War. They go back and study the wars in Greece. They study what Hannibal did. They study the Roman wars and so on. Not that they're going to fight with elephants or with camels in the modern era, but they're studying strategy and tactics. And they're marrying that to, if you like, the modern era of warfare, but learning from all the lessons of the past. That's why they have their Sandhursts. That's why they had West Point in America to train an officer caste in the science of art. It is actually a science. We certainly, in meetings like this, go over history for one reason. Not for being interested in history for the sake of it, but learning from history, understanding the strategic and tactical lessons from history, and understanding not just the good features in the struggles of the workers' movement, the defeats as well, why they took place. Can we avoid them in the past? That's the approach of Marxism towards the modern era and towards the attitude towards Leon Trotsky himself. I think that Trotsky's also been vindicated. I've mentioned here in relation to Stalinism, but Trotsky was also vindicated in his defense of Marxism. I would urge any comrade to read his marvelous little pamphlet, Marxism in Our Time. It's as relevant today as it was when it was written in the 1930s. It's a masterpiece of dialectical thinking and applying it to the real movements of the working class. Even comrades who are not versed in Marxism will get an enormous amount out of that. And what was Trotsky saying? As we said at the rally last night, crises are inevitable. The character of those crises we carefully analyse. I'd say to you today, capitalism is facing its greatest crisis in a way. Worse than the 1930s in history. We didn't have time to mention it last night. But the idea that they're out of the woods, they could face very quickly a double dip. In fact, it's one of the most likely possibilities now in the situation. The money that they've got from the government through these stimulus packages, has it been used to plough back into industry to create jobs? No. It's been used in another speculative bubble where risky assets are being bought up by the bankers. And that could lead, according to Rubini, an economist in America who agrees with us, that could lead to another financial crisis, worse than the financial crisis that took place 2 years ago from 2007. There's no real hope of an expansion of the productive forces. Of course, capitalism always has a way out. But on the bones of the working class, with the terrible suffering of big sections of the working class, a certain unstable equilibrium can be developed. We hear no more of Greenspan, of Fukuyama, because the prospect for the working class today is of a joyless, of a jobless, and probably of a creditless boom, so-called. The boom will be in the pockets of the ruling class, of big business, and not, unfortunately, for the broad strata of the working class. In other words, the fundamental ideas worked out by Marx, defended by Trotsky, defended us in the dark days of the 1990s have been demonstrated in their accuracy in the developments that are taking place. Now I'll end on this last point. Of course the world has moved on since Trotsky was murdered. And as it did for him and Lenin, by the way. They didn't live in the 19th century. They were defending the method, as I said. And they corrected, by the way, some of the misdiagnoses that were made by Marx and Engels, to be more exactly brought up to date. Trotsky, for instance, made a few mistakes in the 1930s. For instance, on the issue of the black population of the US, where he held out the possibility that a separate state could develop there. We have analysed that in our material, and we said, no, events have overtaken that particular prognosis. But even when he made a mistake of perspectives, it was still interesting to see the way that Trotsky approached it, and one could learn from that in applying those ideas to the modern era itself. This is why Trotsky is relevant. He himself opposed any idea of monuments being built to himself. And the best monument to Trotsky is not in a physical way in stone, but is in the building of a movement that represents his ideas and carries his ideas into practice. But he made a prediction towards the end of his life, especially after that trial of 37-38. He said, when the working class of Russia overthrow the malignant, greedy, brutal, gangsterish Stalinist regime, they will build monuments. First of all, they will knock down the monuments of Stalin. And that was brilliantly confirmed, by the way, in 56 in Hungary. And of course, in all the other risings that took place in the Stalinist states against the Stalinist regime. But he also said the future generations will build monuments to those Trotskyists who were killed in the camps. I would say the biggest deficiency in the world today, and why service gets a hearing in the former Soviet Union, Trotsky is least well known in the country of his birthplace because of the monstrous distortions that took place, not only of Trotsky but of Lenin as well. They used people like service in the 1990s. Gorbachev said there's no blank spots in history. There's no black spots. There are black spots, unfortunately. One of the biggest black spots from the point of view of Marxism is a balance sheet of Stalinism. And if we don't have that balance sheet, you can make mistakes, for instance, in Venezuela, in Cuba, by not learning from the mistakes of Stalinism and the ideas of workers' democracy. So Trotsky, his prediction was not borne out in relation to the monuments for the left opposition, or for himself, but they will be in the period that we're moving into, because capitalism shows no way out in the West, shows no way out in Russia. For the peoples of the world, it's a blind alley. And when the peoples of the world and the working class moves, always, every class looks back for lessons from the past. If we weren't here, by the way, they would look back in Russia. What happened in the revolution? Who were the major figures? They'd find a way with difficulties to the ideas of the left opposition. But we can shorten that period of learning by creating a force here, together with our comrades in Russia. CWI has 40 sections throughout the world today. Some very strong, some powerful, some not so strong. But if any comrade thinks, well, what can a small organisation do? Reflect on our record, never mind the record of Trotsky. We had no more than 8,000 members in the 1980s. We changed the world with those 8,000 members. We defeated Thatcher in Liverpool in that marvellous movement. We followed it by burying the poll tax and burying Thatcher with it in the mass poll tax movement where 18 million people refused to pay the tax. We were discussing this on the way here. In Russia, in Czechoslovakia and East Germany, the forums there, the civic forums, had no more than 2,000 members. They could have taken the power in East Germany. If we would have had 2,000 members, we would have put forward the ideas of workers' democracy that were thrown up by the workers in the course of that movement, and the whole of history could have been changed. We're moving into a period when a clear ideas, a clear programme, will find an echo amongst the working class and can have a much more decisive effect than we've seen in our movement and in our work in the difficult 20 years or so since the collapse of the Berlin Wall. That alone makes the relevance of Trotsky absolutely vital today, and I hope in the course of this discussion comrades will raise points, raise questions about history, will answer the points that I've made, so we can prepare the basis of comrades who are here, of comrades who don't necessarily agree with Trotsky or what he said. I hope they'll come forward in the discussion. We can use this discussion to raise the level, to examine Trotsky's ideas, and in that way prepare for the movements of the working class that inevitably will take place in the future.